Good day, revered one. The Lord directs me to share this with you. As you read the mail, you should sympathize with my current situation. My name is Kayomi Isabella Watumi Gwanza from Port Harcourt, Nigeria. Was narrowly escaped from the tsunami disaster, which affected my also eardrum, and was claimed the lives of my entire family, husband, Joseph Caramel Sunday, and a snake bit my two sons, Hugo and Tom, who went for holidays in Sri Lanka, Malaysia.
Kayon, what are you writing?
It's my first ever Nigerian 419 scam email.
Yeah, but it's full of mistakes and weird diction.
I know, that's what makes it trustworthy. Anyhows, I am fine, hoping yourselves are too, for as the Bible saying, what shall it profit an orange to wine the whole world, and yet lose its sauvignon? Bye for now. All right, that's it.
Aren't you supposed to mention a large sum of money in a concealed overseas account that can only be accessed by some kind of fee?
Why would I do that?
So you get money from them?
You mean they would send me the money and I would keep it? That wouldn't be ethical.
Yeah, that's why it's a scam.
I thought it was just a fun thing to do, like tweeting or Instagram. I just wanted to be a part of it.
The good news is there's a package for you downstairs. It's a whole case of Dom Perignon from your dead uncle.
Really? That is so awesome. I missed him.
The guy downstairs says he needs cash to cover the shipping fee.
Oh, yeah, of course. Let me just see. You know what? Just take my wallet. If there's not enough cash in there, maybe he can just use a credit card.
I knew you'd say that.
Anyway, listeners, the next time you hear from me, I'll be popping open some champagne. Meanwhile, here's a show about confidence games. And now his financial advisor is Marty Ponzi. Colin McEnroe.
I figured go with a known name. I've heard about the Ponzi. It's well known in investment circles. I thought we'll go with a well-known name. So we are going to talk about hustles. We're going to talk about gambling. We're going to talk about confidence games. And our guests today are Maria Konnikova. She's been on the show many times before. She's a staff writer on psychology and culture for The New Yorker and an author of Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, and now The Confidence Game, Why We Fall for It Every Time. Joining us in studio is Jack Farrell. He's the author of Fast Jack, The Last Hustler. It's a memoir about his days as one of the best card and dice mechanics. We'll explain what that is, actually. On the Eastern Seaboard in Germany and a lot of other places. So, and there are real, kind of some real differences between the two things that we're going to be talking about here today, but there's some real similarities too. And so, Maria, we're going to begin with you and just, you know, reading this book, I had the same reactions I think that a lot of people have reading about stuff like this, which is, how can people be so stupid? I mean, you tell this story of, well, the Sylvia Mitchell story is a pretty good example of this woman who, well, I'll let you tell it. Tell the story of this woman, I think she's a former dancer or dance instructor or something like that, who is victimized in the most insane way possible by a pseudo-psychic.
Absolutely. So Sylvia Mitchell is a now infamous psychic who has been jailed, unlike most psychics who never get caught and never actually end up making it into prison. And she took advantage of this poor woman who had just gone. She had just gotten over a breakup. She was in New York moving out of her ex-boyfriend's apartment, and she had just lost her ideal job, which was as a dance instructor. She'd lost the love of her life, or who she thought was the love of her life. And she stopped by this psychic parlor, Xenia, where, lo and behold, she met Mitchell. And step by step, Mitchell drew her in to this very elaborate scam where she ended up spending thousands of dollars that she didn't have. So she took the money that was a mortgage on her house that she'd taken as an emergency fund since she was a single mother. And she ended up giving it all to Mitchell. And by the time she came to her senses, Mitchell had cashed all her checks, even though she had promised that she was just taking them for quote unquote safekeeping to help her learn to get rid of her wealth, learn to let go of material possessions. And the money was nowhere to be found. And it took a long time for her to finally press charges.
All right. And just to put a little button or exclamation point on that one, too. I mean, part of this was she was told by Sylvia Mitchell that she had been an Egyptian princess and that a lot of her problems had come from this overattachment to money. These problems dating back thousands and thousands of years in previous lifetimes had dated back to this overattachment to material possessions. So one of the ways that she was going to get over this was she was going to write this check for $27,000 or whatever it was. And Sylvia Mitchell would hold it for her just so that she would have the experience of unburdening herself. She could always get it back, of course, but that's sort of not how things turned out. So one of the things that this story is as good as any other one to explore is that question of trust. Now, it seems like an incredibly gullible thing to do, but one of the points that you make is ultimately we'd be paralyzed if we didn't trust people. If we had to cross-check and double-check every single encounter we ever had all day, I mean, we wouldn't be able to function.
Absolutely. And trust is actually the evolutionarily advantageous way to go because, as you say, if we distrusted anyone, every single person we ever met, society wouldn't function. It would fall apart. And what we end up learning when we look at the studies that have been done about trust is that trust ends up being very good on both on a social and a personal level. So socially, societies with higher levels of generalized trust end up doing better economically. They end up more stable, better social institutions. And that makes total sense because you have to cooperate to develop and to create these sorts of things. And on a personal level, being trusting is actually correlated with being more intelligent, with having a healthier life, with being happier. So these are all positive things. And most of the time, trusting others doesn't get us into trouble. It helps us get ahead. It helps us forge lasting relationships.
So Jack Farrell, this is a difference between a lot of what you write about in Fast Jack and a lot of what Maria writes about in her book, in the sense that a lot of the action in your book unfolds in backroom craps games, card games, where there isn't a lot of trust, right? I mean, there's sort of a latent assumption. If I meet somebody in a coffee shop, I don't think, well, they might be lying to me, they might be conning me, they might be trying to take advantage of me. But in a lot of the environments where you operated, that was more of a latent assumption, right? That somebody might be cheating somebody.
Yeah, that was an assumption, because that was the name of the game years ago. Anywhere where there was private gambling, the larceny was going to surface. And that just happened to be a fact of life.
And one of the things that you write about, and I think it's an interesting point, is that nobody really cares about you or wants to know that much about you until you start winning, right? And then there's lots of questions?
Exactly. The questions would be fired away as long as if you were winning. If you were losing, they didn't care who you were, what you were. But once you started winning the money, they were like FBI agents. They fired the questions at you.
Now, there's two things that I saw in the stories in your book that resonate very interestingly with what Maria reports about sort of how we function cognitively. So one of them is, when I'm reading your book and I'm reading about how you and sometimes your associates, your confederates, would work a place like this and pull a lot of money out of it, I find myself thinking, first of all, I wouldn't have the nerve to stay there after you'd won as much as you'd won or to go back there the next day or the next day. But you're able to do that and victimize sometimes the same people over and over again. And it's, I assume it's, A, because once people have lost a lot of money, they want to win some of it back from you, right?
Yeah, and a lot of them were degenerate gamblers, and that was just the nature of the beast. Any business I did, it was like making a movie. I was the director and I was the main player, and you have to make a good movie to make it believable. That's what I did all my life.
Right. And so that's storytelling. We're going to come back to that in a second because that's really important, and that's in Maria's book too. But I want to just – there are like lots of little cognitive points that Maria makes, and then you read Jack's book, and they're there. So one of the things that you do write about, Maria, is this notion of sunk cost. Like after you've lost $10,000 to Jack Farrell, you probably should walk away as opposed to continuing to play. But that's not actually how we're wired, right?
That's exactly right. So it's called the sunk cost fallacy for a reason, because what we do is instead of rationally walking away and realizing, okay, we've already spent this money, we should just take it, write it off as a loss and not lose any more. What we end up doing is investing even more because we want to rationalize and justify the fact that we've already spent this money. And it's not even the case of gambling. There's a really interesting study where people who've bought tickets that were expensive to a show that they didn't even want to go to would go in a snowstorm and drive for hours and hours to get that. And that, you know, that so much time, effort, energy, and you don't even want to go see the show. But instead of saying, you know what, we've already bought the tickets, it's a sunk cost, you want to invest even more resources into it.
Now, Jack, another thing I think that worked in your favor is also a notion, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, that when people are gambling and things aren't going their way and maybe are going your way or the way of one of your confederates, that they think it's going to turn at some point, that that's the way the world works. It can't be the case that the dice turn up this way every time or that the same person wins all the time, that there's sort of a natural probability that things will get better.
Yeah, and most gamblers, they have visions of grandeur, and they like the adrenaline flow, too, the fact that they're gambling. It's a big high. Gambling is, I think gambling is probably the strongest vice there is, stronger than being an alcoholic or a drug addict. It's so compulsive, and these are the people we would target, a lot of them.
So, yeah, in Maria's world, they'd be studying the release of dopamine and all kinds of other pleasure-causing chemicals in your head when you're winning. But when you're losing, it's a different thing. So, Maria, and I thought this was – we did a whole show about half a year ago about pattern recognition. And I'm not sure we actually got to this part. It's really, really interesting. So we think we can recognize patterns. And we can recognize patterns. It's one of the things that it kind of allows us to function, that we can see patterns out in the world. But Maria, one of the things that you point out is that we're actually kind of bad at recognizing certain patterns, even when it becomes clearer. There was this really interesting experiment. I don't know, could you easily describe that check and plus experiment? I know it's a hard thing to explain, but it makes a great point.
Sure. So this experimenter said, basically, I am going to say check or plus, but before I say it, I'm going to say now, and you're going to have to predict what I'm going to say, check or plus. Okay, so that's fine. But he actually wasn't saying them in a random order. He had certain people listen to instructions where there were more checks, a lot more checks or a lot more pluses or a pretty equal amount. And what he found was that people, even though theoretically we should recognize that, hey, we should be guessing check because there are many more checks in here, 75% checks, they end up really disliking it when a lot of checks come in a row. So after two, three, they start guessing plus, even if they should be guessing check, just because it makes them ridiculously uncomfortable to see that sort of a streak. And the more in a row you have, the more inaccurate they become.
And so, Jack, I mean, that goes back to one of the ways that you were able to succeed, right? These people should be able to recognize a pattern. This game isn't proceeding randomly, that in fact, things are breaking a certain way a lot more often than they should if things were completely random. But people aren't good at that, right? They're actually uncomfortable believing that.
Well, most of them don't even notice it, but but when you when you're doing what I did for over 50 years in a dice game or card game, the unnatural happens because I alter the odds by switching dice or switching cards or cold decking. So I totally alter the odds. But the player doesn't recognize that. He might go home and think about it that evening, but you don't make it so landerous that they can recognize it. But it's there if they really observe it. It's really there. And anytime I've ever had a problem gambling, it's always from an outsider, one that is not participating because his adrenaline isn't flowing, he's not caught up in the action, and he's just an observer. He's watching maybe his brother-in-law or his brother gambling with us. And that's when I used to have a big problem, when it was someone that was not participating but was just observing.
And Maria, I would assume that makes sense to you, too, based on what you learned about the people who win and the people who lose.
Absolutely. Actually, I was going to jump in anyway and say that is the absolute pattern that you see when it comes to cons. People who are in it, who are emotionally involved, their emotions are running on high. They are so hot that they stop thinking rationally. They don't see red flags. They're just totally blind to them. To an outside observer, it looks like a huge red flag. They say, how can you not see this? And this is that person standing by who's not actually involved. What they don't understand is that they are looking at it from incredibly different perspectives, because when your emotions are turned on high, you stop thinking rationally. You can't. And so I would say, you know, always have that outside observer with you and listen to them. And yet we don't listen to them. If we're in that gambling situation, even if it's not actual gambling, if it's a con, we don't want to listen to outside advice. We want to keep on believing.
So, Jack, let me ask you, you about your emotions, too, and your brain chemicals. This is, you did a very dangerous job for a very long time, and you, for the most part, were able to do very well at it and to profit from it. But not all the time. Your book is full of these, some of these very narrow scrapes where maybe somebody would figure something out but ultimately let you go. And then things that really aren't escapes, right? I mean, you know, you paid for this. You got beat up. You had to go to prison. But somehow or other, you kept coming back to this, right? So there's something about it that you liked, too.
Yeah, well, with me, a lot of it wasn't even – haven't figured it out yet, but I don't think it was totally about the money, because money came easy to me, and it wasn't. It was the – I was in command. If you were playing against me, I controlled your money, and I controlled you. I controlled the outcome of the game, and that was big to me, and the adrenaline flow with me, living on the edge and being the attention. I had all the attention. If someone called me from Europe, in Greece, and I didn't know him too well, and he was a new agent of mine, I would tell him he has to send my plane ticket. And if I really didn't trust him, I'd say, if the game is so good, then send me $5,000 cash, and I'll be on the next plane. And every agent I treated differently. Some I had gave total trust, but a lot of them I didn't. And they'd have to give me money in advance before I would show up. And that was just the way I worked it.
Well, a lot of what you have to do is be a good student of human nature, right?
Positively. Yeah. Positive. 1,000%.
Tell us about that. Like, how do you size somebody up?
Well, I ran a lot of Vegas-style dice games. And there are probably a Las Vegas table that probably there's probably 15 to 20 people that are shooting dice, and as each one would shoot the dice, I would study them or study her, and by the time they all finished, I would have a good idea of each individual and how I was going to handle them, if they were hostile, if they were passive. I wouldn't know how to handle that personality, and that's what I did all my life. Weighing up the personality was very important. It was a major factor with me. It was the major factor.
And I mean, maybe elaborate on this a little bit more, too. So it's not that if I'm hostile or I'm passive or I'm uncertain or whatever, that disqualifies me from dealing with you as far as you're concerned. You're just going to handle me a little bit differently? Like, how would you handle me differently? Let's say I'm a hostile guy. You figure that out right away.
Well, first, I'd probably find out what nationality you are. And you being Irish, I would attack that part of you.
Yeah.
Because I know you're pretty proud of that. And yeah. Most of us are. Most of us are proud of our heritage. And I would try to get a one-on-one friendship or conversation with you, and that would be my objective to turn you and make you enjoy my company or like me.
All right, Maria's thinking when the paperback version of The Confidence Game comes out, she wants to have talked to Jack at greater length. I think Maria Konnikova is with us. This and Jack Farrell, who's the author of Fast Jack, The Last Hustler. Again, Maria's book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. So, Maria, you're listening to this guy talk, and it really is like he's just from a missing chapter in your book, right? This whole idea of sizing people up is something you come back to a lot. The people who are really good at this can do it.
Absolutely. And it's even it has a name. It's called the put up. And it's the first step of any successful con. And in some ways, it's the backbone of the con, because if you size someone up correctly, you can sell them absolutely anything. So there are con artists like Victor Lustig, the Count, who ended up selling the Eiffel Tower not once, but twice. It's one of the most famous cons of the early 20th century because he was able to size up his marks so incredibly well. That psychological program profiling. So what Jack was talking about, you know, I have little light bulbs of recognition going off every second, because that's exactly what you have to do. And your approach does differ. The great con artist doesn't have a set playbook that says, okay, first I say this, then I say this, then I say this. Instead, he knows exactly how to sell you what you most want to buy. And by you, I mean you personally, Colin.
Yeah, well, exactly. And Jack was just describing how he was basically going to get me to like him. And this, yep. Maria, is something that you found too. I mean, I think you found it personally, that's a technique.
Absolutely. You learn as much about the person as you can. So you're Irish. I know your name. I can use these things to actually try to get you to trust me, because this seems elementary, but you have no idea how often people can't actually remember someone's name. And so when someone does remember your name, lo and behold, you really like them, because you say, oh, what a great person you are, because clearly you remembered someone as important as me. And then when you're saying, oh, you're Irish, you know, we have so much in common, I'm Irish too. And suddenly you're talking about different things, and you're friends. And friends are people that you trust. You like this person. And I found when I was talking to con artists that they did this to me. And I knew that they were con artists, and it still worked. You still feel incredibly flattered that they've taken the time to kind of do their homework, that they know stuff about you. Some of them would quote my articles back at me. I'd think they were the awesomest people ever until I realized, wait, no, stop. This is a con artist. This is not good.
So, you know, Jack, this is something that I think really jumps out in your book, too. And it's not just at the gambling tables, but it's figuring out what's important to somebody, right? It's actually one of the really fascinating figures in your book is Billy Grasso. Billy Grasso is a guy, I mean, I've been a journalist here in Connecticut a long time. I didn't intend to write about this kind of stuff, but everybody knows who Billy Grasso was. He's this really kind of like straight out of The Sopranos organized crime figure. And you think about those guys and you think that all they really want to do is get as much money as they possibly can. But even in the case of Billy Grasso, a guy who really knew the game, you write in your book that at a certain point you could see Billy Grasso change and something became more important to him than just getting money.
Yeah, and it was... as the years went by, Billy was very successful at what he did. He was probably, and I met a lot of, up and down the East Coast, I met a lot of La Casa Nostra members, and Billy was on top of the list of getting the job done. Mm-hmm. And he accumulated a lot of money, but all of a sudden something changed in him where the power became the factor, not the money. He had the money. Now the power became... and he totally changed. It was all about the power with him. The money was flowing in, but he just changed, and it was a scary change for everybody, for everyone, and that's what evidently led to his demise.
His untimely demise, yes. All right, so we have to take a little break here. We're with Maria Konnikova and Jack Farrell. Their books are The Confidence Game in Maria's case and Fast Jack in Jack Farrell's case. We'll come back after this.
You can get away with anything. It all comes down to style. You'll have a captive audience as long as you beguile.
All right, we're back. We're talking about hustles and cons. We're talking to Maria Konnikova, the author of The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, and Jack Farrell, author of Fast Jack, The Last Hustler. He's John Farrell in his author title. That's his memoir about a life playing very dangerous games at times with rigged dice and cold decks and lots of other things in gambling rooms all over the world, really. So, and by the way, if you've been going to the movies a lot and if you saw Black Mass, there's Whitey Bulger scenes in this book. Jack's gotten into cars with Whitey Bulger and Steve Fleming. There's also some scenes straight out of Bridge of Spies, too, because Jack was working hustles in Germany right around the same time of the Gary Powers exchange and stuff like that, too. So it really is. If you've seen those two movies, you can flesh out your understanding of those two scenes a bit reading Jack's book. So, Maria, I'm going to start with you. Jack is really good, got really, really good at feats of sleight of hand, basically, slipping rigged dice into a game, doing these cold deck substitutions, which he explains in great detail. But that's not enough. It's not enough, and you can tell reading his book, it's not enough to get you through, that you've got to have all these other skills. One of them we already talked about, that's sizing people up. But there's also storytelling. So, Maria, I'm going to first of all start with you, and then I'm going to have Jack give an example of how he used storytelling to further his aims. But one thing that you discovered, Maria, was con artists are good storytellers.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's crucial to what they do. And even if you think about people whose cons rely only on sleight of hand, like three-card Monty operators, they're also creating narrative drama. They're not just operators. They are screenwriters. They are figuring out what is the arc of the story. How do I get you emotionally invested? How do I get you to trust me and to be part of this? And you see it with magicians, too. I mean, the best magicians aren't the ones who are the most dexterous. They're the ones who tell the best story so that they can manipulate your attention the way that they want to, so that you don't even see their tricks. You don't see them coming. That's exactly what con artists do. They weave these stories that you want to hear. You become a part of the story, and then you're emotionally invested in it. And at that point, it becomes almost impossible to pluck you out of it and to say, hey, I think you might be getting conned. You don't want to hear it because this is your story. You're part of the narrative.
And so, Jack, let's do some storytelling or show how you use storytelling. So you're over in Germany. You're working a club there. And you know that. And one of the things that you do, first of all, is you hang around there not winning for a while. First of all, you hang around not playing, just letting people get to know you. Then you hang around not winning. You just play the game straight. So you either win or lose, depending on actually how the dice roll. So you do all of this before you start slipping your dice into the game. This goes on for days and days, maybe weeks and weeks. But then you start winning. And then, as we said at the beginning of the show, the minute you start winning, there's a lot of questions. Who is this guy? So what happens then?
Well, excuse me, we call it winning heat. And I had a partner, just two of us in the game, myself and my partner was a Greek named Yorgo Vassiloris, and it was at a Greek club on the street, was Konstras in West Berlin. It was about 1979. And by the way, West Berlin was an extremely intriguing city. The wall was still up, didn't come down till 89, and it was really exciting for me, and I loved it. But we were taking off this dice game, and now the questions started coming, and no one knew that Yorgo and I were friends or partners. And after I would leave, everybody would ask Yorgo, where's this guy come from? What did he do, fall out of the sky? Who is he, this American? And finally, I come up with a story that I went to the major army base in West Berlin, and as luck would have it, I caught a young army guy, 19 years old, and he was from Springfield, Mass. And I propositioned him. I gave him $500 to go in and get me a uniform, and an officer's uniform, by the way. And I gave him another $500 for the uniform. And about a week later, after I had it tailored, because you never saw United States military wear uniforms in downtown. It was just too dangerous. Yeah, I think you all remember when the disco was blown up in downtown Berlin. And I wore the uniform. I wore a raincoat and took the taxi to the club. And I walked in. I took the raincoat off before I went in. I walked in no one could believe it, that this is – I didn't even tell them what I was. They knew who I was. They knew I was a colonel in the United States Army. And I went on and played, and probably another 2 weeks after that is the game just broke up because it dissipated. The money was in Yorgo's pocket and my pocket, and the game was over. And that's how I got over this hurdle.
You know, I want to ask you a couple of other things about this and then throw it back to Maria, because I think this story also has some things in it that maybe illustrate some differences between you as a guy running gambling hustles and some of the con men that Maria writes about. Because I noticed a couple of things. One of them was that you in particular were there to victimize a couple of guys from Hamburg who were pimps and dope dealers, and that your contempt for them is there in the pages of the book, and you're there to clean them out as much as you can. And you've already cased them out. You size them up. You know about them. You know that they're coming before they even get to Berlin. Meanwhile, there's a guy, I think his name is Fischer, who because this is his club. Oh. And one of the things that you talk about is that you and your partner actually tried to keep him out of the game once you rigged it, because you liked him. I think you call him a good family man. But he liked the heat so much that you couldn't do it. You, without telling him what you were actually doing, you couldn't really keep him away from the game. But I noticed that, like, at the end of the day, you'd slip him 50 Deutschmarks or something like that, maybe help cover his losses a little bit. So it seems as though you had devised your own code of honor. It might not be the exact same code of honor that everybody else has, because you're running hustles after all, but you had certain ideas about who you liked and who you didn't like, who you were willing to victimize and who you weren't.
Yeah, well, first, I just want to say that I'm by no means a con man, but I had a great imagination and I had a big heart. I had a good heart. I like to experiment and a guy like Fisher, I found out in my 50 years of gambling that most of the people I beat for big money could have been my friend. They were good guys. They were good human beings. They were classy. They were just good people. And I reflect back and I look at that. And it was just a pattern that was always there for me. And I used to feel bad about beating them. In the meantime, I had to pay the mortgage. And that was the name of the game.
So, Maria, this I think in analyzing con men, who are a little bit different from what the kind of hustle that Jack does, you talk about a dark triad. That's Machiavellianism, narcissism, and psychopathy, and that it's sort of there in different mixes and different blends. Did you find con artists who tried anyway to think about this kind of the way Jack's describing, to try occasionally to think with their hearts instead of with their heads?
Well, I think that a lot of con artists will tell you that that's how they think. I don't know that we can necessarily believe them, because they are incredibly good at rationalizing the people that they're taking advantage of as either greedy or deserving it in some way, shape, or form. That's where the narcissism comes in. They say, I'm not taking this from you because I'm a bad person. I'm taking it from you because I deserve it more, because, you know, I'm the one who should have this, not you. And so I think all of them on some level think of themselves as good human beings. So this guy that I follow throughout the book, Ferdinand Waldo Demara, Fred Demara, if you listen to his own descriptions of himself, he is the nicest, kindest, best guy that you will ever meet. And yet then when you look at what he does, I mean, this guy didn't just ruin lives. He put lives in physical danger. He operated on people, actually cut them open without a high school degree. And yet if you talk to him, he'd say, oh, I'm actually a really kind, big-hearted man, and, you know, I never took advantage of anyone who didn't have it coming to them.
You know, I want to ask you about him, too, because he's very similar. People who've watched the movie Catch Me If You Can, he's kind of a similar story to Frank Abagnale, a guy who could just take on different identities, often using Jack's technique also of putting a uniform on. Somehow other people believe you're a pilot or a doctor or whatever, if you're wearing the right clothing. That's just enough. But, you know, with all of these guys, Maria, I feel as though they're so smart and so talented that they really could have done just fine in the legit world. You know, I mean, this guy that you're talking about, who was able to slip into so many jobs and in fact operate pretty successfully in just unbelievably adverse conditions. He's on a pitching aircraft carrier or some kind of a naval boat, and he's operating from a textbook or some guide he's been given by some other doctor, and he's operating pretty successfully on people. He's not a doctor. That's a guy with incredible skills and resources. And why not just, you know, take all that keen intelligence that he has or that Jack has and, you know, be a CEO and make billions of dollars?
You know, that's such a great question, because so many of these con artists are remarkably intelligent and talented human beings. And you look at it and you say, my God, if you just invested this energy into something legitimate, the world would be a much better place. But for them, I think it's a matter of mindset. There's something about getting away with it, because it's not like it's less work. It's actually a lot of work to craft a false identity, to keep this deception going. You have to work just as hard as you would at most jobs. But I think two things happen. One is that they really get a rise out of that sense of power over other people. The ones that I spoke with, you could tell that they really love what they do. They love taking advantage of people, and they think that it's just a total rush saying, you know what, I'm affecting your life and you don't even know it. So I think that's part of it. And the other part of it is that to them, it seems like a shortcut. They think they deserve it now. They think they're smarter than the guys with the PhD, but they don't want to take 10 years to get their PhD. So they're going to give it to themselves now because they think they deserve it. So they're just going to, you know, take those 10 years and wipe them out.
You know, Jack, what about this? You were nodding when I said this before. You're obviously a really smart guy, and you have these incredible skills. You could have probably made a lot of money in the real estate market. There's a lot of ways you could have made a lot of money. And there's certainly people listening, particularly if you've seen the movie The Big Short, who are thinking, well, the CEOs are. They're just a different version of that. They wear different clothes and they do different stuff. But they rig games just the same way Jack's putting his own dice or cards into a game. Boy, if you look at what happened in 2008, it does look like something very similar happened at a much higher level. But do you ever think about that? That maybe your life could have been easier just taking all the smarts that you've got and using them a different way?
Yeah, Colin, I think about it almost every day. And I'll be honest that I loved my job. I loved what I did in life. It was exciting. I got a lot of attention. I was the main guy. Things didn't start until I showed up. And it was just an exciting life. But I have so many regrets now because I realize that after all is said and done, I cheated myself because I think I could have done much better than what I did. In fact, I know I could have. And if I had to do it over again, no, I would not. I would not do it. And for the past 2 years, I've been thinking about the stress factor involved, and it really didn't affect me at the time, but it bothers me now. It really bothers me that I put myself through all that, you know.
Well, obviously, there's an incredible amount of stress in this, right? I mean, the problem with being an adrenaline junkie is you ride out those incredible highs where your system is just racing at this incredible space, and then you crash down to these other lows, and I'm sure it takes a toll on your body, your psyche, your heart, everything, right?
Yes, and I would a number of places that I gambled in, I knew the problem going in that I would have a problem if I got caught, and maybe a dozen times, excuse me, I would sit in my car and I would meditate for a half hour, an hour, and I would tell myself over and over, Jack, you're the best at what you're doing. Nobody knows what you're doing, so go in and do it, and I would.
This absolutely needs to be a movie. All right, I want to grab a quick call here from Peter in Mansfield. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, Colin. I have a question about a con that was played on a friend of mine almost 50 years ago. He was a pretty streetwise kid who went to New York, and what he told me was that he was in Times Square and somebody approached him and made some kind of a proposition that involved him doing something and getting very well paid for it, like transporting some money across to the other side of the city. But that to prove that he was trustworthy, they had to do a few things. So the con artist, as I recall, gave him $100, said, put it in your pocket, walk around the block, and let me see whether I can trust you. So he did that. And then the second part of it was that then my friend had to give him, the con artist, $100, and he was going to walk around the block so that they could see whether they could trust each other. And, of course, the con artist didn't come back.
All right,
and I'm just wondering whether your guests have heard of that and can add any more detail, because my friend is no longer alive, and I've always wondered what happened.
Right. Well, this is certainly in Maria's book, and it's also straight out of a movie that both Maria and I really love a lot called House of Games. So, Maria, one of the things that Joe Mantegna says in House of Games when he's instructing Lindsay Krauss on how you do this, he says the first thing he shows her a con, and then he says, you notice the first thing I did, I offered you something. I offer you something before I ask for anything.
Absolutely. And that is one of the first things you have to do, so after the put-up, after you've done the psychological profiling, you establish trust. And one of the ways of doing this is to take advantage of the fact that people are actually going to trust you. Now, you know that you're not trustworthy. They don't know that. And they think that you're actually a trustworthy person because you've trusted them. And so many cons operate exactly the way that your friend was conned, where you have legitimate money being given to you, and then you end up with nothing because then that money's taken away and your money is taken away and it's never coming back. And you don't see it coming because to you, this was an exercise in trust. And if that person gave you $100, well, that person couldn't have possibly been a con artist, right? Because you could have just walked off.
Right. And so, Jack, I'm assuming the gambling version of this is you just don't start out beating somebody. You let somebody else win, or you play it straight for a while.
excuse me, yes. And a lot of occasions when we'd key in on maybe one individual, like one time in Hanover, Germany, we were beating a German guy that had just sold two businesses. And this is the other part, that when people are vulnerable, that's when when they're most vulnerable, that's when you can beat them for a lot of money. And he was going through a divorce. He had plenty of money, and he was drinking every day. And I had a phone call at 4 o'clock in the morning. 2 days later, I was in Hanover, and we were beating this individual significantly. And one of my partners, who was his partner, but what he did is he showed him how to beat me by using two dice that had double fives as opposed to two and five. He had two fives instead of the two. And he went for it, and he started playing with those two dice. But in the meantime, I was switching dice in and out, and he lost. The larceny caught him. Right. The larceny caught him, and we beat him for a very significant amount of money.
Right. This is also in Maria's book, too, the examples of people who—
The reverse con.
The reverse con, people who think that they're conning and they're getting conned.
Exactly.
All right. So we got to take a break. We're going to talk about art fraud, too, here. It's an amazing and very colorful show here today. We'll be back with more.
I'm down here with a delivery guy. It's actually two cases of champagne, but can you send an intern down with your winter coat and boots? We need to borrow them.
Oh yeah, I'm on it. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Sarah Flaherty and Stephanie Reef. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Guy claiming to be Bill Curry. For show pages, articles, and a PDF of the Here and Now staff's title to the Brooklyn Bridge, visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, The Nose wonders why Sean Penn didn't get an Oscar nomination for his portrayal of a journalist. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, we got a lot of things to talk about in The Nose tomorrow, but we got a lot of things to talk about today, too. In the studio with me is Fast Jack. That's the name of his book, and that's who he is. He's John Farrell. Fast Jack, the Last Hustler. And by the way, later today, up on our website, after the show, Jack's going to do some work with dice. Dice or dice and cards?
Dice and cards.
So he's going to do some, maybe he might even show you how to do the cold load and all this stuff. The filmmaking auteur Ryan King is going to shoot all that. So we'll have a video up on a line later today. You can see how Jack did what he did in the good old days. Also with us in the studio in New York is Maria Konnikova. Her book is The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. And we're also going to talk a little bit now about another aspect of this, and that is art fraud. Art fraud is in a category all by itself, but it also has some things in common with what we're talking about right now. You probably follow some of the big stories involving this, and Anthony Amore is right at the heart of this. He's director of security at Isabella Gardner Museum and the author of most recently The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. So, first of all, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Colin.
We should say that, I mean, first of all, some of the stuff that we've been talking about is about as old as the human race, and the kind of stuff that you write about, art forgeries, are certainly about as old as the nation. So tell us about the first one, the Gilbert Stuart one.
Well, first of all, you make a good point. I say a lot of times in lectures that I think the first art forgery was the day after the first caveman drew something on a wall, and a guy drew something the next day claiming it was an original. But the first one in the United States took place when we were a brand new country, and Gilbert Stuart had painted the seminal piece of the depiction of George Washington, who I think nowadays we don't even understand just how he was the most famous person in the world, not just in America at his time. And everybody wanted to see what he looked like, and everybody wanted an image. So Stuart, who died broke, had protected the painting that he did, the famous Anthoneum portrait that you see in the $1 bill. He protected that image very carefully. A ship's captain came to him looking to buy a copy, and Stuart it would interview people, making sure these weren't going to be used to be mass-produced. And a guy named Captain Jack Swords came to him and assured him he was only purchasing the image, the painting, to give to a gentleman friend in Virginia. So Stuart trusted him and sold it to him, and then Swords took it and sailed directly to China, where he had 100 copies made, and brought them back to the United States, and they're all over the place. These still out there, scattered around the country.
You know, Maria, you've got some stories about art forgery and art fraud in your book, too. And we did a whole show about this a couple of years ago. And one thing that I noticed talking to a guy who does it is the people who do the forgeries. Now, this is a little bit different than the hundreds of skilled artisans in China. But the people who do it kind of one-on-one take a lot of pride in what they do. A lot of them wind up kind of going legit, or some of them have wound up going legit afterwards. And they want you to know they're good artists.
Absolutely. So one art forger that I spoke with, Ken Perenni, who spent multiple decades creating forgeries, some of them from classical American art like Butterworth. His claim to fame is that his Butterworth was on the cover of not one but two auction houses. I believe both Christie's and Sotheby's bore his cover art. That's how good he was. And he thinks that the people who fell for it, well, they deserve to fall for it, because if you can't tell the difference between what he does and the real thing, then why in the world should you have the real thing? And he wants everyone to know. He is so proud of what he does, because he says, I am a brilliant painter and people should know this. And he still paints today. He paints legitimate forgeries, so he doesn't actually sign them, but he sells them and people buy them. And he says that some of his clients actually try to pass them off as the real thing and usually succeed.
You know, Anthony, these things are often very hard to detect, and sometimes it's this minutiae, the accidental right-handed brush stroke in a Da Vinci, and sometimes it's what they almost call I think Thomas Hoving called it the sixth sense that a connoisseur has, just a nose for it, you know, this is or this isn't. But we've got a lot of new technology now, and I'm wondering, is that making it easier to be a forger or easier to detect a forgery or both?
It makes it a bit easier to detect a forgery, but it's not just the technology. The key is the person who applies the technology has to have a real strong understanding of art history and of conservation techniques. You need sort of that trifecta to be really good at detecting this art. I think one of the keys, now Ken Perenni is a very good artist, but one of the things that I found in you know, my day job looking for stolen art is that you encounter a lot of fraud, and there's a lot of very good forgers. I work across the street from an art school. I mean, there's dozens of students in there who can recreate these paintings. But of course, when you get into the minutia, like you mentioned about the pigments and sorts of things, that's where they get caught. But the key to the whole con, the key to the whole forgery game is what Jack talked about earlier, that vulnerability.
Yeah.
And you have these people who are looking to purchase something very, very expensive, so that they can be the person who found what no one else could find. That's their vulnerability. They want to believe they found something special. That's how they prey on them.
We're almost completely out of time, and I could do a whole other show here with Anthony Amore. But Jack, just to prove that everybody who's ever done anything of this kind is in Jack's book, Robert Gentile. I don't know if that's how you say his name, right? He's in your book, and he's been the guy that the FBI has been sweating over the Gardner heist, and he's a guy you know, right?
Well, I'm sure Anthony knows also that Gentile and I have been neighbors in Manchester for over 50 years, and he's been an on-again, off-again friend of mine for over 50 years. And we parted ways about 8 years ago. And I probably know more about Gentile than anyone.
All right. Well, we have to stop it there. But let me once again thank Maria Konnikova. Her book is The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Fast Jack is the book by John Farrell, a memoir of being the last hustler. Anthony Amore, The Art of the Con, the most notorious fakes, frauds, and forgeries in the art world. That's it for today. Thanks to everybody. We'll be back tomorrow. Like a fool, I let you break my heart. I'm a pro at being calm. I'm a pro at being calm.
Welcome to American Bank. How may I help you?
Hi, I'd like to wire this money to Nigeria, please.
Is it going to a representative of a Nigerian prince who needs to transfer $40 million obtained from an oil account but cannot use an African bank and therefore needs your assistance?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There will be a $10,000 bank fee for that, made out to me.
Very good.